and a goddess who favored him. But could Nico sleep in his rest place or in his bed?
Sleep? I didn't. I couldn't, Stealth replied. Too much to do. Too much going on.
Tempest wondered if that was the only reason Nico hadn't slept, but let it go. A third of the sacred band prepared the training field to hold the horse lines until new stalls could be built. Another third worked clearing the ruins. The rest readied the pyres for 10 dead men, lost to fire and smoke and fury. A sad day, this, for one and all. But reconstruction already was beginning. Tempest's 3 Ascalonian horses and 11 others had burned to death in the flames. Too many war horses and warriors lost when real war loomed. It takes so long to train and season cavalry, each horse and man is impossible to replace. Everything in life is borrowed. But Tempest grieved for lost war horses in a way he never did for men. The only good thing that had happened was the addition of the black stallion to the band's string. When sacred banders came in from burying grisly quarters of horseflesh or dragging branches or building stalls and paddocks, they joined the crowd around the big stallion, tied in front of Nico's quarters. Sink came up to Tempest and said,
"Is that a real horse, do you think? Can a horse be that good? And will it breed true?"
And the Thebans came by, admiring. Karen said, "My son is in love with that gold-muzzled stallion and Nico's colt as well. And, by the way, Torchholder says let him know if we're going to wreak any more havoc in his town or his mage guild. He was complaining."
"Molin always does. Lysis is doing a good job tending convalescing horses. Let's hope we do as well, healing our sacred band's wounded and putting our dead to rest," Tempest told the Theban.
They had scheduled the rites for tomorrow night at sundown. Karen wanted to add games with prizes dedicated to the newly dead.
"You can have your games, Karen. 2 or 3 events. Crit will help you. Tonight you can do as you wish after sundown, in honor of your dead."
3 dead Thebans. 6 dead mercenaries just hired, 1 stepson of long standing. It wasn't going to be easy for anyone to say goodbye.
"Nico and I won't be here."
Brown-skinned Gorgias, face like a battlefield, came up behind Karen and said,
"Won't be here? The goddess will miss her favorite when the songs are sung."
For a moment, Tempest didn't know what Gorgias meant, but then realized. Nico had that stallion, a gift from their goddess. She'd healed him in the barracks where all the Thebans could see. Thebans were starting to think of Nico as an avatar of their goddess.
"Karen, Gorgias, don't let your Thebans start worshipping that horse, no matter whose horse it is now or whose it was before."
"Or its new owner. Hero cults complicate everything in a sacred band."
Tempest knew from experience.
"We're going to the city. We'll be back before the night is done."
The Thebans went their way, rejoining the crowd around the big black horse with the golden dapples. Tempest called his best together.
"Stratton, get Ishard and bring her here. While you're in the city, order what replacements, tack and carts, materials and supplies, you may. And hire some laborers. We need stables in working order. Critias, you're in command here. Chorus goes with us today. Get him now. Gian, go up to Wizard Wall and borrow a dozen horses from Bashir's successors. Get them here as fast as you can. Use cloud conveyance if you must. Randall, try once more with Simi to make her come. And bring Sink's third commando back here. All but 10, and their mounts.
With the Storm God's favor, he and Nika will be back in time to smell the smoke and burning flesh of his 10 newly dead fighters on their pyres. Enlil is hot within him now, fuming, swelling up inside his skin against his flesh, pushing him back inside his own skull so that his head throbs. When Lord Storm is angry, swirling in him, he must go very carefully until a battle worthy of the Storm God is joined. Enlil is an impatient god, pushing Tempest to go faster, shoving his humanity aside and hungry for the fight. But this is a cannier enemy than they have faced before, who must be drawn in, lured, made to come to them, or else he must find a way to Meridian, straight on, past the ground and sky. From Sanctuary it just might be possible to reach Meridian. Sanctuary has always been a border town between mortality and immortality, its feet in hell and its fingers stretched up to heaven, a place where anything may happen and sometimes does. When wills are strong and mysteries invoked, all of his go running to their tasks, hearing the god in his voice, taking furtive backward looks. Thebans have only seen Enlil come to ground one time before, out on the jetty, when the god took their pretty little goddess in the sand. They may see the storm god of the armies in all his glory yet before this fight is done. If Enlil's wordless fury is any harbinger of war to come. Now they feel the pain, said the wizard boy to the dream lord.
Now you be careful, said the dream lord to Shamshi, in a dark place in Sanctuary,
in its mage guild where borders between realities are thinnest and shadows play. There is ancient poison in the dream lord's veins, blazing. If he were flesh and blood like Shamshi, he'd be dead of it by now. But he's been alive so long and traded off so much that his flesh and blood lie thinly over his entelechy. This boy, Shamshi, has brought such ruination and damnation upon everything and everyone he's touched that even Ascalon is appalled. But this youth, this wizard boy, or what is left of him, is Ascalon's creature now. So much substance of the mortal boy has been replaced with the stuff of dream and nightmare. Even the regent of the seventh sphere is unsure of what he's got.
Be very careful, Shamshi, whom you see and what you do and what you say when you're abroad tonight. We've hurt them badly, their heart for war.
We can destroy them, if...
A flicker shivers over remade flesh that once was Shamshi and now is something else, something darker. not quite comfortable among the likes of men.
If you still wish it so.
The youth didn't see Ascalon struck by the poisoned dart, but he knows something is amiss. Ascalon doesn't trust this wizard boy. He knows Sham now, too well.
We'll destroy them, if destiny allows. Meanwhile, we go to Meridian to prepare.
Ascalon waves his hand in the warmth and dark, his fingers spread. Shadows between those fingers thicken and trails begin to form. Those trails make light and heat and stream out behind his hand, forming into azure sea and softest sky above Meridian, whose crystal quays, golden streets and shining spires are more beautiful than man can make. And they are there, in a heartbeat. The regent of the Seventh Sphere has been lord of Meridian for thousands of years. It is inconceivable to him that he will not be here for thousands more. At his arrival, lutes are strummed and pipers pipe and horns begin to play. His lion-rammed barge is floating at its dock, ready. Down the wide and perfect streets his welcoming throng approaches. Things are mostly as they should be. Sea lions bask and seals cavort and dolphins ply his waters. Yet there is a rustiness to his skyline, a smudge around the edges of his island chain, a decay in streets beneath his feet that should be smooth and straight along his route. Clouds above are tinged with grey, where he wants sunlight. Lutes are slightly out of tune, pipes sound spitty, tentative. Denizens seem more dazed than even their dream life warrants, and Meridian has never tarnished before. The archipelago of dreams only touches reality once every 1,000 years, unless he so commands it. Is the poison in his blood leaching into Meridian itself? Can it be so? After so long a reign, can rot set in? Can dreams rust? Can acid eat at the foundation of the land of dreams? He mustn't let Shamshi know he is weakened, but he is. And, weakened, he is worried. For the first time in millennia, he feels a remote, corrupting pain that will not leave him. It's in his substance, eroding the glue that holds his person fast. It's in the world around him. How sad it would be if Meridian and the Seventh Sphere dissolved, leaving dreams unmanaged, nightmares out of hand. As a palanquin arrives to take them to his palace, he pensively regards the youth beside him. Blonde and grey-eyed and fair today, as handsome still as ever he was, when he's here. When he's elsewhere, he's a spectre, disconcerting, sometimes manlike, sometimes not. Dissolution is in the air. Ascalon can smell it in his nostrils. For the first time in eons, he must prepare for war. It is inconceivable that with all his skills, a physical encounter might be needed. But Tempest is a fool, and rooted to the earth and all its violence, and every edge of every building on Meridian, is wavering, every comfort being eaten away by dark where light should be, and light where dark should be. Dissonance is here. Some strangeness in the proportion afflicts his inner ear, throwing him off balance. And lest dissonance be here to stay, Ascalon must hasten to protect Meridian, this timeless, perfect place of dream and shadow. So he raises up his hand and calls his multitude to war. So many who have been here forever. So many who have died in sleep or dream, so many whose dreams are violent, retaliatory, or worse. Here they are, coming up the causeways and out of the buildings, even tramping up from the quays with measured tread, ready for combat, for hostilities, for conflict or confrontation, for warfare of any sort he might decree. If an army is required, he can field one. If the rules are changing, then no rules apply. So it may not matter that so many who serve him are already dead. Dying in dreams is still dying, and dreaming on, they dream what dreams Ascalon commands.
You'll pay how much? To raise one empty building? You're on, said Zip to Tempest, outside Zip's warehouse down on Wide Way. You'll clear this with the palace? I'm not looking for any trouble with Walgren or that lot.
Zip is dark, hawk-faced, thin. This Ratfall boy has grown up in the margins of Sanctuary. Midnight dealing is his stock and trade.
I suppose there's no use in me telling you I don't do this kind of job anymore, that I don't have the men or the muscle or the heart for this.
Zip scoffed in a meager pool of light beneath a single torch and leaned back against the warehouse brick.
No, there's not. I'm just a businessman, Sanctuary style.
Come see me when it's done, and remember, none of yours needs to go inside. Just burn it down and collect your pay. Zip still wore a slingshot at his hip. Old habits die hard, when they die at all. This warehouse is purposely ill-lit and well-positioned for a man needing to watch his back and the street in both directions. Zip looked away from Tempest at Nicodemus, on the black horse at Tempest's right, and said,
I see you're still here, pretty boy. Still coattailing your way to glory. I like the Riddler's daughter better. Do you do for Tempest what she used to do for me?
Zip grinned, teeth flashing in the torchlight. Nico's new horse took a step forward and snorted, undue pressure from his rider's calves. Nico said, If I were you, wanting to keep those white teeth in that cutthroat's head, I'd be about my business, now. Nico's black took another step forward, two more, and Zip must dodge to one side or the other or be pushed against the wall. Tempest said, Nico, give him the keys. From astride his big black horse, Nico tossed the keys. 1, 2, 3. Zip caught them all, but had to lunge clumsily to do it.
You're both better than this, rebuked the commander and wheeled his trouse.
Nico followed on the black, who might as easily have pushed Zip into those bricks or chased him down the wall.
"He may be, I'm not," Zip called after them. "Thanks for the compliment. I'll remember that you're sweet on me yourself, big fella. But flattery won't reduce the cost of this little gambit one bit, not one bit."
The cost of this was liable to be lives, not coins, so Tempest didn't answer. Offer made and accepted, bargain duly constituted in sanctuary, lives were cheap and fools died often. This Zip was smart. He'd lived a decade longer than he should have. If Zip was as smart as Tempest thought, he'd live through this. If not, then that was part of the cost of this customary thieves' world contract, arranged in the traditional way, in the dark of night, on a nondescript street where a midnight mover ruled over a crew of hand-picked unfortunates who'd dare whatever they must to keep their bellies fed. Tempest had warned Zip not to go inside the Mage Guild or let any of his street fighters and brigands go in there. More he couldn't do. He felt a little twinge of pity for Zip, who'd lived long enough to become cocky about what he could survive. But prudence was in short supply this season. In his head, Enlil growled and ramped, eager for blood to spill and battle to be joined. Gods live forever. Men die in multitudes. So despite all this encouragement from on high, Tempest was proceeding with caution. For the first time in a long time, the god rode through sanctuary with him. Peering through his eyes, his hand on Tempest's reins, wanting to rend and tear and devour and flatten all he saw. But this was no longer Enlil's territory. This beleaguered city belonged to Vashanka, rival storm god.
"Burn the whole town down, cowardly servant. Lazy avatar, they don't deserve you, or me, or life itself. Make an end to this place with your fighters, and I will meet Vashanka on the battlements of his temple. A blasphemy in my sight. You do not need that girl goddess or her unfaithful avatar, once my own. You need only me." "Enlil, you let the Dreamlord set fire to my barracks, kill my men and my horses," he retorted as silently as the god had spoken to him. "Where were you then, Lord Storm? Where was your might against that blaze from hell? If you think to push me into battle prematurely, you think wrong. You are not the only lord of war these days. There is the Theban goddess hereabouts. And Vashanka rises. Look to your adherents and treat them better, me and mine. And bide your time, Ravener. This battle will be one to sate even your hunger. Now get out of my head so I can think. Be thee quiet, be thee patient, and all that thou wills shall come to thee." His breath was bated, his pulse beat fast. He wanted to ask the god to heal his heart, to make it beat as once it had. But he didn't. When you asked something from Enlil, you needed to know what you would trade. Down past Shambles Cross, where her little house nestled by the riverside, Stratton tied the ghost horse to a shard's low iron fence and waited respectfully to see if the witch would come.
When she didn't, he tried her gate. It wouldn't budge. But it wasn't hanging askew on its hinges, either.
"Ishard," he said under his breath, "let me in or come out here to me. It's the Riddler's business."
The ghost horse whickered behind his back. He wheeled around. This place was full of undeads, tortured souls. No one knew that better than he. He remembered watching Nico embrace Janny here. Of all he'd seen and all he'd done in life, that image of two stepsons, the living and the dead, embracing by the white foal, still haunted him the most. Strappen wasn't like Nico, afraid of nothing in this world or the next. The ghost horse raised its head, calling out again. What was coming? You could meet your doom here in a heartbeat, end up in the White Foal River where corpses floated till they waked. Cloying darkness surrounded him, as on so many other nights when he'd come to her like this, waited for her like this, ached for her like this. Then she was there, no wings, no flutter this time, walking out of the bushes as if she'd been for a stroll by the river. But the ground was treacherous there, where the swollen white foal lapped stones from neglected graves and altars and worse. Stones you didn't want to disturb on a summer evening when the moon was just waning. "Stratton," she breathed, and he thrilled to her voice. Her eyes didn't float off her face. She was his beauteous Ishard tonight, smelling of nightshade and jasmine. Her dark cloak enfolded him as she put her hands around his neck and drew his head down. He hoped she'd eaten already. Then he didn't care, so sweet was the kiss she gave him, soft as a spider's web. "Ishard," he said when her lips left his, before he couldn't remember why he'd come here or what he wanted or anything but the touch of her and the love for her, which was the greatest love he'd ever known. But for the ghost horse. That horse stomped a foot and made those soft, short noises that horses make when greeting their loved ones, not whinnies, not even whickers or knickers, but softer sounds, right up from their souls. "Ishard, I..." He couldn't recall what he wanted except her touch. He couldn't remember why he was here except to drown in her eyes, content. "Ishard, get her, convince her, here I am. This is our night. It can be," the ghost horse told him, pawing the ground with one forefoot. "Yes, Stratton. What is it? We'll go inside. Boost her up on my broad back and we'll have our ride. Across the fields, through the streets, and on we'll go, just we three. Ride away we can, far as the eye can see. Away from all of this, just you and her and me, forever, just we three," urged the ghost horse, shifting from hoof to hoof. And he couldn't remember what he had to say. With his arms around her and her hair tickling his nose, then he did.
"The Riddler said to get you, right away. There was a fire at the barracks last night. 10 men dead, 12 badly burned, 14 horses killed. He's planning something. We're moving. The commander wants you with us."
"Ah, I see. That explains all the disturbances. All the unrest. So many spirits discommoded. She took a step back, no longer pressed against him. Now he can think.
Please, Ishaut, I'm here for you.
The ghost horse whinnies.
Right now, come for a ride. Out of here and away forever. My strong hooves can carry us wherever love wishes. We can go another way. Just we three, before it's too late.
And the horse paws the ground again and snorts impatiently, craning its neck at them, imploring with its eyes. Ishaut moves quickly now, decided. Get up on him, then, and give me a hand. We'll ride out there, just we three. Ishaut glides over to the ghost horse and pats its neck and croons to it as Stratton has never seen her do to anyone or anything, man or beast. He'd never known whether the ghost horse talked to her, or was really talking at all, or whether that horse's voice was only a whisper in his head. But he swung up and reached a hand down. She grasped it. Her hand was cool and dry and strong. When he swung her up behind him, she was lighter than air, hardly there at all. And the ghost horse let out a loud whinny of joy as it trotted, then cantered, oh, so carefully, with his shard up behind, toward the barracks and whatever Tempest had in mind. Corus was on his own, on the big blue roan waiting for Torchholder in the forecourt of the palace, watching clouds scud across the moon. When the priest arrived, Merlin was frowning.
"It's the middle of the night, Giscarus. What do you want? What do you need?"
"My father, Vashanka, needs you to do as we instruct," said Corus.
And it was true. The god was moving in him, sharing his sight, sharing his body, whispering around in some part of him he'd only suspected was there. Until last night. He had been scourged, inflamed, encompassed, and reborn as if he'd walked into the stable fire and out again, which he had, unharmed for the most part.
"Listen, Giscarus, this is not a ceremony. You're carrying things a bit too far. Is no one here to be impressed?"
Then the priest glanced up at Corus's face and amended,
"I'm sure we can help you, and Vashanka. Just what is it?"
The priest's eyes darted around the courtyard where guards stood, leaning forward, trying to hear. Merlin took another step toward the big blue roan.
"What is it?" he whispered.
Corus would have gotten off his horse if it were yesterday or the day before or any other day. Now he stared down at the priest and said, "Fire at the barracks. Horses and men killed. We need resupply and labor. The Riddler sent me with a list of what you must provide us. Now."
"Must? Now? You and Tempest are entirely out of control,"
blustered Torchholder, and then thought better of it, seeing Corus glare and realizing how many eyes and ears were on them.
"Give me your list," Torchholder sighed. "We'll see what we can do."
"Good," said the stepson, and the god in him agreed. "One more thing," he added as he handed Torchholder the parchment the Riddler had given him. "Two, actually. First, there's going to be a problem at the Mage Guild, and you're not to interfere. Tell Walgren, stay out of there. Second, the girl from the ceremony. I want to see her. I want to know her name. I don't want her dying like my mother. Is that clear? You're responsible to keep her happy, and to have her here for me any time.
Any mishap that befalls her, that same mishap befalls you. We decree it.
Giscarus? I can't be responsible for every temple dancer and slave and concubine.
Of course you can. It's part of your job. You're Vashanka's priest. You do as the god decrees. Mark us. If she dies, you die. When and how, the same.
And he reined his roan around the way Sink had taught him. A full 90-degree turn, and kicked it into a lope, and rode out of there without a word. When the gods had hustled out of his path, and he and his horse were through the gate of the gods and headed for the hill, he slapped his thigh as hard as he could.
Yes, he told the horse,
and the knight and the god rustling within him.
Vashanka, being your avatar is everything I could have dreamed and more. Now, Storm God, let's get that Shamshi, just you and me. Come on, Sham, come out and fight. Come meet me, or run from me and my God if you're too afraid. Are you scared? You should be. Run then, Sham, run and hide. We'll find you.
Chorus was exultant, full of a strength he'd never known before. So he didn't see the fluttering shadow that darted across the street in his path, or hear the crossbow letting arrows fly over the blue roan's snorting, until it was too late. A quarrel hits him in the right side of his chest, rocking him back, puncturing his armor. A quarrel pierces his gut just above his thigh, stopped by his hip bone. A quarrel penetrates his back between his shoulder blades. He screams in outrage and pain. The blue roan leaps forward. Frenzy overwhelms the pain engulfing him. With a strength he has never known and a speed he's never had, he spins his horse in its tracks and drops the reins.
Seek, he tells it.
With his left hand he works one crossbow bolt out of his armored chest and the second from his gut, unworried that he'll break off the iron points inside him.
He's so angry and so fast that he can think and move between the waves of far-off pain.
He can't reach the third crossbow bolt in his back, but he can reach his short sword and his throwing stars. And Vashanka is one with him, pouring strength into him, filling him with wrath and lust for reprisal. He has his sword in one hand and his throwing stars in the other. Shooting a crossbow from a saddle is always difficult. It's hard to aim at a moving target when the weapon being aimed is moving as well. So he leaves the crossbow on his saddle. He doesn't know that he's crouched down along his horse's neck. He doesn't know that he's bleeding. He can see the enemy flickering, a shadow moving. It's too fast to catch, although he tries to speed up his horse. This horse has never gone this fast. The shadow is faster, too fast. They chase it through alleys, better streets. This is the hill, and soon he knows he's lost this antagonist. The streets are lit too well for anyone to hide from him. He has god-sharpened sight in his mortal eyes. He has the hearing of the god keener than his mortal ears. He holds his breath, thinking he hears the enemy breathing hard. Panting. But his horse is blowing, hoofs pounding louder than his quarry's sounds. Now he hears his adversary. Now he doesn't. Then it's gone, too far away. Chorus can't track it farther. His head is spinning. He needs to stop. He halts the horse. There's wetness everywhere. His blood. The quarrel in his back is bobbing there, the weight of the quivering shaft hurts worst of all, a bruising throb whenever he moves. He wants to go back to Crit's hidey hole, but no one is there tonight. He sits on the blowing roan in the middle of the street. It's too late in the evening for many to have seen him. The horse is heaving. They've run a long way. Chasing something so elusive, even Bashanka isn't sure how to find it. He tests the guard to see if Bashanka will speak. Silence. He's getting dizzy, lightheaded. The dizziness and the pain seem to belong to someone else. There, but far away. The god is still in him, propping him up, guiding him. He knows he has to get that arrow out of his back. If he can get the arrow out, he'll heal. He knees the roan. It goes walking through the streets. He's not directing it. But something is. They find themselves at the promise of heaven. There's a house nearby. The horse stops there. Corus knows he can't ride much farther. He needs to get the arrow out. He slides off the horse and drops its reins. He winces when his feet hit the ground and the shaft in his back bobbles. There's a door in front of him. He knocks on it. It doesn't open. He pounds on it with the pommel of his sword. Now someone comes and blinks and puts hand to mouth. "Oh, gods! Corus, what's happened?" asks Shawmy, her robe hanging open, forgotten as he staggers a step. Covered with blood, and sinks forward. Sinks toward her. Sinks toward the robe. Sinks toward the floor. Sinks into a place where there's only the god, and his wounds, and Shawmy's hands and voice. "Oh, gods, Corus, what happened to you? Mary, get me some hot water and some clean cloths." He wants to tell Shawmy not to worry. He knows he'll heal. The storm god is taking care of him. Didn't Vashanka lead him straight to her door? But he can't find his voice, not right now, or even his tongue. It's so good to lie still and rest. He feels women's hands on him. He feels the crossbow bolt as it is yanked out. A grunt escapes him, nothing more. Bashanka is inside him. He tells them so. These women tending him. "The storm god loves you," he grits out. But it's not really true. Corus loves Shawmy. Always has. Even Vashanka knows it so and lays his avatar down in the arms of his beloved as the world reels away with his blood, and the pain goes with it. Corus thinks the god is standing over him while he sleeps. He can see the storm god, Vashanka. Yarrow, honey hair, clubbed back. High brow, free from lines, one foot on each side of him, brandishing his glowing short sword. The god won't let him rest. Nightmares have a special sting this night, like vipers from the deepest pit of hell. He mustn't dream, the storm god tells him, and keeps watch over Corus, his new avatar. Until the dawn. Before sundown, they begin the ceremonies. This time, at the pyres on the hilltop, the ritual is so different. Nico expects an exalted calm and intimate remembrance, subdued, formal. Instead, the bereaved call their gods to earth, believers trying to rebalance, desperate to reestablish equilibrium in tragedy's wake. The way up and the way down is one and the same, Tempest often says. Here on this late summer afternoon, it's true. The road between heaven and earth is open wide. What goes up comes down and goes up again. Nico thinks he's imagining it at first, but as dusk approaches, there's a feeling none have felt before. A presence of more than mortal nature. Grief-stricken fighters contest in funerary games on horseback and on foot. Cavalrymen catch rope rings on their swords, hoplites cast javelins at oxhide targets. Charon and other Thebans play their flutes and pipes and sing songs to harmony. And the sky is clear, full of early moon and stars. A milky road to heaven seems to beckon, yet the sky stays blue. Daylight won't lose its battle against this night without a fight. Smoke curls around the mourners and wafts upward. So many have come to honor the sacred band's dead. Priests from the town, laborers, carpenters, armorers, horse traders, and more. Sink's woman is among them. Blonde and small and quick, pitching in, helping where she can. Nico and Tempest see to the burial of the 14 dead horses. At Tempest's order, Nico begins the ritual but can't finish. So Tempest says the rest. Nico's throat closes up. 14 horses died for their masters, not knowing or caring why. But that men asked them. And now all these are together in one hole in the earth. Some few stepsons attend this graveside funeral among the grasses and the weeds. Nico watches his commander, unflagging, willful lips drawn tight, enduring every trial with that expression all stepsons know so well. This massive strength, shoulders pushing forward into a future no man can see, tireless, relentless, and inexorable as the dawn. If he could become half of what the Riddler is today, he'd be content. Tempest claps him on the back when the rite is done and says, "Next time, Stealth, you'll do it all." Next time, he hopes there won't be one. His burns are healing, scabs itching, nearly gone. So fast. Too fast. What is he now? Not a horse in a grave or a man on a pyre, but something else. Something that heals like his commander does. He doesn't want to think about it. Not today. As they prepare to head back toward those grieving for dead fighters, Nico notices that Artan, thin, intense and hunched with sorrow, has come to the horse grave with Lysis, his Theban partner, to honor their equine dead. And Sink is there with his woman by his side. Nico and Tempest lead their horses from the gravesite, side by side. They won't ride them here today. Behind, in solemn processional, the other stepsons follow. The two stallions, the silver and the black, represent the equine god, whomsoever horses pray to, in this ritual so ancient that no one knows what god to thank. "Thank Poseidon," say the Thebans, "and Epona, the Greek goddess." "Thank Stormbringer," Jehan says. So many gods claim the horse, perhaps the finest creation under heaven. Man and horse have worked together longer than either can remember. But these two stallions know their brothers and paw the ground and trumpet their grief and thanks to heaven. It must be enough. It always has been. Horses know what to say for horses. Men know what to say for men. When life has fled and spirits soar and the bereft are left behind, tethered to the earth. So all of them walk together in a somber group, back through the copse and up the rise, where the games have ended. The rites for the sacred band are getting underway. Stealth watches the young pair, the seer and the Theban, who has the blessing of harmony and the love of horses in his soul. New stepsons, new blood for a new sacred band. Atop the rise, they can see the altars of Harmony and Enlil and hear the rituals proceeding. The pipes play sad songs, then sweet songs, and the flames roar high. Three Thebans, six mercenaries from Seir and Makhad and Taisi, one stepson who'd been with the band for years. All these dead are ready for their sortie into heaven on plumes of smoke. But Abarsis doesn't come to take the souls of the sacred band as he's always done before, materializing in the balefire. Abarsis thunders down from the sky in a chariot with blood-red harness and two white horses. This is Enlil's chariot, come down from heaven on a road of cloud. Everyone is choosing sides, in this world and beyond. And then the goddess Harmony is there in her black armor. Into the flames the goddess walks and lifts up her first faithful man of Thebes tenderly. Arms around her neck, the soul is smiling as he goes his way. Then she returns to get another. Miko's own soul aches to see her walk into that inferno and out again. This goddess is his dancing girl from the beach. She's so much more than Nico should aspire to. His body wants to stop her, keep her from the conflagration, from all harm. But it's she who kept him from harm, time after time. No part of frail flesh and blood is she. Each time she braves the flames, he holds his breath. But she's not mortal. And because of her, he no longer knows if he is. He can't reconcile love and trepidation. Doubt racks him. What has he been doing, dallying with her, a being of such power? What is he been thinking? His heart thuds in his chest as he watches her take the souls of the Theban sacred band to their rest. There is no music now. No pipes play, no flutes. And Tempest is watching him closely, gauging his reaction to the goddess standing in the flames. When the Theban souls have all gone, Harmony steps back and to one side and stands with head bowed, Nico's sable mare attentive beside her. Now comes Abarsis to Enlil's altar. The original stepson, the slaughter priest, patron shade of the sacred band. Fiery-eyed white horses of the gods stand stock still as Abarsis walks into flames. He takes stepsons, old and new, lifting up each soul in turn and then comes out again. The Thebans may not know what they see, but they sense Godhead in Abarsis, heaven's emissary on a mission. Every stepson there recognizes the gravity of this honor, that Abarsis would appear in flesh to take their dead. People drop to their knees, heads pressed to the ground, in fear and awe. Even outsiders bow down. All these folk from Sanctuary who have never seen a funeral for fighters of the sacred band. Abarsis walks among them and no one looks or raises up a face. The goddess walks beside Abarsis and people close their eyes and cover them. Tempest looks at Nico and Nico spreads his hands. I didn't call him. I didn't pray to him for help, he tells the Riddler. Or to her. Howsoever, the slaughter priest, full-blown, envoy of the gods, treads their barracks ground while chariot horses with coats white as snow wait, motionless, for their driver. At her own altar, Harmony lingers, spread-legged, her armor gleaming as if she hadn't walked through flames for 3 Theban faithful. She stays a while among the throng, touching a Theban here and there, lifting them up and talking to them softly. She is their tutelary, and their faces shine with joy and thanks to see Harmony there, and touch her and speak with her. Nico's black stallion sees its mistress and wants to go to her. He swings up on it, and Tempest mounts the troce, and they wait. This ceremony is in hands more exalted than theirs in this dusk fading into night. Nico is more and more uneasy, and sees the same in Tempest. He feels as if something is ending, something else beginning. Change of this magnitude is never easy. Tempest wears a wary face. Nico sits this strange horse as calmly as he can. This black horse is better than any he's ever had, but this is no time to exult in the treasures of the living, when so many of theirs are newly dead. And he doesn't like this ceremony. His mot is restless. Too many powers are here. Abarsus has only come to them this way before in the direst of times. Abarsus mounts Enlil's chariot and drives it over to Tempest and Nico.
Tempest, Nico, life to you, and everlasting glory, Abarsus says in a voice like clear water running over pebbles.
And honor to you and glory, stepson, says Tempest, and Nico says the same.
Abarsus is fully here, real as blood, not a ghost or a shade this night. Upswept eyes so wise, black hair glossy on a young bull's neck, flaring cheeks and tawny skin as beautiful as ever.
You too. Take care in this battle coming, says Abarsus. Too many forces are aroused. I will be with you. Enlil will. The gods want to bring a better day, and you are their messengers. Trust not in all you see. Trust only in your hearts, and in us who love you both, says Abarsus, and shakes his reins and drives between their mounts and away as those white horses climb a ramp of cloud up to the sky. The chariot rattles like thunder from the heavens, but the night is clear. No mist obscures the moon.
And as Abarsus disappears, there are more stars above than Nico has ever seen.
Even the troth horse is skittish now, watching Abarsus and that chariot of white stallions swallowed by the sky. It dances and prances. Nico's goddess-given black tosses his head and challenges heaven as Nico sidles it over to the Riddler. Then Harmony comes riding on the sable mare, her helmet by her thigh. So, stepsons, are your reinforcements all like him? She gestures with her hand to where Abarsus's chariot had left the earth, where no wheel ruts remain, no hoof prints mark the ground. A question hangs in the air. Nico doesn't know what to say to her. He's looking at his mare. So are many of their fighters. All around the grounds, wounded men wear dressings, horses too. Open burns are slick with unguents and grease, but this sable mare is free of burn or scratch or blister. Touching each other on the arm, Thebans whisper. Clustered together, Even Critias and Sync stare at the mare askance. And Harmony is so different today. All war goddess, armored and brave and brave.